Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It is Friday, March the 1st, 2013. Hopefully spring can't be too far away from us. It's been an interesting winter so far, certainly. Tons of snow and tons of crazy stuff coming out of Washington. I don't know which blizzard is worse. Those of you who are new to my program, just to fill you in, I am a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service, an agency whose mission, at least allegedly or on paper perhaps, has been picked up by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a division of the Department of Homeland Security, the DHS, an agency that continues to boggle the mind. And boy, you know, if I ever thought that that agency was in a state of free fall and bottom was elusive, in fact, bottom is illusory. There is no bottom. That's why I've come to call DHS, frankly, folks, the Department of Homeland Surrender. Ever since 9/11, I have been out there taking my show on the road, as it were, to try to get the American people and our leaders to understand the real significance of our immigration laws. Our immigration laws are designed for just two purposes: to protect innocent lives and protect the jobs of American and lawful immigrant workers. In essence, when a politician says that he doesn't want to enforce those laws, that his town, his city, his state is a sanctuary for illegal aliens, what they're really saying is, we don't care about you. We don't care about your safety. We don't care about America's national security. And we don't care about your ability to support yourself and your family. It's quite simple. That's what this program is generally about, providing that perspective, the information that's difficult to find elsewhere. I will tell you, I've been on Fox News a couple of times this week. I was on earlier today with the delightful Megyn Kelly, first time I've been on her program, talking about something that I will be discussing with Lauren Martell, who will be joining me momentarily. She is an attorney and an immigration activist from Hilton Head, South Carolina. She helped make it possible for me to participate in the Tea Party conventions in Myrtle Beach last year and this year, just recently. So she is delightful. She is knowledgeable. And I'm thrilled she's going to be joining me this evening. But, you know, I just want you to realize how screwed up we are. And I'll be bringing her on momentarily. But before I do that, I just want to call your attention to three websites. If you want to read a little bit more about my background, find out what really has me going and what's in my background, rather than spend airtime doing that, I'd rather be speaking with the lovely Lauren Martell, I will simply ask that you go to my website, michaelcutler.net. That's one word, MichaelCutler, michaelcutler.net. I have a second website, talkborder.com. We've got some great video interviews up on that website, TalkBorder, talkborder.com. And finally, it's a delight to work with a group of folks. They are truly out of this world in Santa Barbara, California, beautiful downtown Santa Barbara. And that group is CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. Their website is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. Made some great friends out there. I hope they're listening, and I'm glad you're listening. And so with further ado, let me see if Lauren is ready to join us. Lauren Martell, happy Friday.
Hey, TGIF, back at you, Mike. How are you?
I am terrific, young lady. Thank you so much for joining me on my show.
It's always an honor to be able to be on your show and to talk about these very serious issues that affect every single American.
Yeah, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a challenge or threat that's not being hammered because this country, this administration in particular, refuses to enforce the immigration laws, refuses to secure the borders in a meaningful way other than to pay lip service to it. And you know, this latest lunacy that's had me running around like a crazy man, I'm actually doing four radio shows today. I did a TV appearance earlier today with the delightful Megyn Kelly, who does a great job. It's always been fun watching her on TV. It was a privilege to join her. But I got to tell you, releasing criminal aliens into communities across the country, you know, maybe the next time there's an election, the question shouldn't be, are you better off, but are you safer?
Right, and that is a valid question. I think they've been asking that every single year after, 9/11.
Yep,
and,
the report cards and so forth.
Mm-hmm, and I think the overall consensus is absolutely not. We've actually gone backward. I've heard some people say that, especially with this latest move in cuts and in not really preparing ICE for what they need to do, not in encouraging people doing the right thing by enforcing the laws the way they're written and they're supposed to be enforced. And then, most recently this thing that we find verified by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement that have confirmed the release of these illegal immigrants. So,
and most of it, and I'm for once, maybe you'll agree with me this time. I am actually, you better sit down and fasten your seatbelt, Lauren. I am willing to take Barack Hussein Obama at his word. He has been repeatedly telling the American people that we are not bothering to arrest aliens unless they have criminal histories. How many times have you heard that statement?
I've heard it. I have heard him say that.
Okay. So if that's all they're arresting and they go into the immigration detention facilities to release detainees, what's the likely nature of these aliens? Criminals, no?
Most likely that their intent is not,
they're a threat to our well-being.
Good. Mm-hmm.
And I find it remarkable to listen to Napolitano, or Nappy as I like to call it, because I have trouble respecting somebody who doesn't seem to stand for anything except placating her boss. The Serb sycophants seem appropriate here, saying, well, gee, the timing was bad. I wish they hadn't done it. You wish they hadn't done it? They are under your command, Madam Secretary.
Yes.
You wish? Is this like a wish list? I wish I got a new car for my birthday. No, she's the boss. They answered to her. What does she mean they wish? I wish they hadn't done it, but they don't answer to me. If I was actually in charge of DHS and this is something I didn't want, I would be out there spewing fire and saying, what in the world are you people doing? Heads are going to roll. No heads are going to roll. No heads
right.
are going to roll.
Right, and in the same in the same time that she's saying, she's not completely in charge of those decisions and she wishes and these kind of things, didn't she come straight out and say that the Customs and Border Patrol would have to force all of its employees to take an unpaid time off and reduce overtime and eliminate some positions
there? To save money. But how are you saving money when crime costs lives and money? Because of our failures to secure the borders, America, folks, is bleeding red and green. And this is not about being anti-immigrant. We've really got to push back. These are like the schoolyard bullies, and we have been too darn acquiescent. Push back. If someone accuses you of something that you know isn't true, confront them. I don't mean beat up on them. That's not what we're talking about. I'm nonviolent. But tell them that they're wrong. Call them out on it. When people say to me, you're anti-immigrant, I tell them, no, I'm not. I am opposed to law violators. I'm opposed to people coming to the United States of America in violation of laws by circumventing the inspections process that is supposed to keep the bad guys out, or by violating the terms of their admission into the United States, creating problems. Again, I was just on with Armstrong Williams. We were having a really great conversation. If it weren't for the fact that I had my own show to go to, I would have loved to have stayed on with him and Dave Modell, who was guest hosting with him. But, here's the point. The laws are designed to keep people out of our country who pose a threat. And you can look it up online, or you can go to my website, or capsweb.org, or michaelcutler.net, or Talk Border, because I talk about this all the time. And by the way, the next time you hear arguments from those opposed to immigration law enforcement, they are anti-enforcement people. They are anti-national security people. They are anti-border security people. They are immigration anarchists. And the next time they come at you and say, oh, these poor people, you don't want to help them, here's what you need to ask them. The world now has over 7 billion, with a B, inhabitants, human beings, at least half of whom live well below what we would consider the poverty line. How many billions can we bring to America? You know, I wrote a commentary, I don't know if you saw it, but I asked this question. Have you ever seen a situation where a parent rescues their own child from a burning building? Have you ever seen a case like that where somebody then yelled at that person, "What's wrong with you? You saved your own child but not other children?"
No.
It's common sense. You'll save your own. Yes, if you can go back in and rescue someone else, absolutely we will do that. But isn't
mm-hmm.
the parent's prime responsibility, isn't it understood, isn't it a foregone conclusion that first
yeah.
and foremost the parent saves their own children? Isn't it a foregone conclusion that the purpose for the U.S. military is to protect Americans before we protect anyone else? When an airplane crashes overseas, if there's even
mm-hmm.
one American passenger on board, bango, you see immediately American investigators head to the scene because there was an American on board. That's this partnership that we have, this relationship we have with America. There's an American on the plane crashes, the FAA, the FBI, everybody gets involved because there was an American life on board.
Well, I'll tell you, we're living in an upside-down situation now. Just what you said, that is completely the way it has been in the past, and you know, the way America has always really functioned. But it's been over time, and you and I have both talked about this, and I agree with you, too, that it hasn't been just only in 4 years. It's been over decades of this
yep.
erosion. It's just been extremely the green light was given for it to really work against Americans since November 6th. And I'll tell you, I have from good information that, you know, people who have just recently come back from Afghanistan are really appalled because they were over there helping the Afghan people secure their borders and teaching
yep.
them how to be a secure homeland. Well, our borders are wide open, and the money is going to these other countries too. So
well,
your child burning.
When mm-hmm. George W. Bush sent out troops to go to Iraq, they sent BORTAC teams, Border Patrol Tactical Units, the elite, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they
mm-hmm.
sent them there because they knew that they needed to block terrorists and insurgents from going from Iran and elsewhere into Iraq. Well,
mm-hmm.
what did we do about our own border? We prosecuted Ramos Compion and went after other Border Patrol agents to make darn sure they wouldn't secure America's border.
Right.
How nuts is that?
Now, that doesn't make sense. So we have to take a step back and try to get into the catbird seat where we're looking at it from a bigger picture. Because obviously when things are happening over time in a pattern of behavior, it certainly isn't an accident. So I ask you, you know, if it doesn't make sense to us, who does it make sense to?
Okay, that's a great question. Well, did you see All the President's Men?
I did, but it was years ago. You'll have to remind me what you're
okay,
going to
do. Okay, I will remind you. See, that now I've got Lauren's cage rattled here, folks. So I like doing that sometimes. Here's the point. And it was an apocryphal story. Apparently, he never really said it. But Deep Throat, remember in the garage, they
right.
were asking him, you know, what's going on? Why is all this happening? And he said, follow the money.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
I wrote an
yeah.
article for The Social Contract a couple of months ago. There's a new one that's out, by the way, and I focused on the victims of illegal immigration in the latest edition. But back then, I wrote a very long article. I think it was 32 pages, if I'm not mistaken. It went on for a bit. And I focused on the profiteers of illegal immigration. Well, not only illegal, the legal system as well. And I called it immigration, the modern-day gold rush. So
yeah.
let's look at the money, okay? First and foremost, do you know who the silent partner to every business transaction is, whether it's legitimate or illegitimate? The banks.
I want to say the Federal Reserve. Yeah, I was going to
no,
say the Federal Reserve.
Not the Federal Reserve, just the banks.
Okay.
And I'll tell you
so
how
like the
it
World
works.
Bank or what? Yeah.
No, the banks, whether it's
okay.
Bank of America, whether it's HSBC, whether it's Chase, because what
mm-hmm.
people do is they send money home. Very often they'll do it through remittances, so it's Western Union as well as the banks. Or they
yeah.
open up a bank account and they use debit cards to move money internationally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? To open up a debit account, you have to put money into the bank. That means the bank gets to use the money while it sits there. They charge fees every time you move the money, every time you use the card. There's monthly fees and user fees and so forth. And if they're sitting on billions of dollars, and they are every year in the aggregate, think how much that money generates in terms of interest for them. So it's the banks. It's the immigration lawyers. They have a limitless supply of clientele. It's the corporations that want cheap labor. And by the way, the labor that's cheap isn't only foreign labor. It also drives down the wages for American and lawful immigrant workers because labor is a commodity. If you flood the market with a commodity and you keep the demand for that commodity constant under the classic rules of supply and demand, increase that supply without changing demand, the value of the supply decreases. You know, most women love diamonds. The De Beers Company, which produces gemstone diamonds, and they're based out of Brussels, they
very
are
lovely.
Very careful. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
Very lovely. Color
yes,
cut.
Very lovely. I actually went to their factory. They actually make certain to not release too many gem-quality stones in any given year. Why? Because if they dumped diamonds on the market, the price of diamonds would drop through the floor. So by keeping it relatively rare, they're able to jack up the price. And, you know, what we're doing here with labor is we are dumping, and that happens to be a charge, by the way, that the Federal Trade Commission looks at, dumping. The Chinese have done that. They dump a product onto the marketplace and drive down the price. They have been dumping workers on the labor market, a market that can't find employment now. And it's amazing. Do you remember in the days before the election, the talking heads on TV were on, and they were totally mystified. How in the world, they asked, could they create 180,000 jobs in the last month and unemployment continued to rise? And I'll tell you how. We are admitting into the United States about 1.1 or over 1.1 million lawful immigrants every year. That works out to about 100,000 per month. Now, it's true a lot of them may be children, but over time, God willing, they will get older. They will join the labor force. So the way I look at it, it's a wash. It's not just the kids that are coming in this year, but it was the people who were kids 15 years ago who are now 23 and so forth. They're coming online and they're getting jobs. So we are admitting nearly 100,000 foreign workers legally into the United States every month, giving them a pathway to citizenship signified by the green card. We are admitting thousands of students. In 2011, the last year that the statistics were available, I'm going to guess the 2012 should be available soon, but 2011, 447,000 foreign visas were issued for students to come to the United States. Most foreign students ultimately get practical training, which is a job. Then you got the H-1B visas, the high-tech visas. You got the J-1 visitor exchange program. You have all kinds of workers entering the United States. Ballpark figure, about 150,000 a month, and that's before we even talk about illegal aliens. Now, a lot of those jobs
incredible.
Are minimum wage jobs, but nevertheless, that's how we are bringing into the country all these people to take those 180,000 jobs. What's left for Americans? The Center for Immigration Studies said that the majority of jobs that are created go to the newly arrived and go to illegal aliens. This is a game of musical chairs where every month they kick the door open and send lots more kids into the room, but no more chairs.
Right. And of these people coming in and getting the jobs, are you saying that a lot of them end up sending the money back to other countries?
Absolutely. We're over $100 billion a year gets wired or otherwise transmitted from the United States to their country. The World Bank, about 5 or 6 years ago, which is an arm of the United Nations, got to love the UN, referred to those remittances as the best form of foreign aid because the U.S. government and American citizens have no control over it. Basically, they looked at it as a form of foreign aid. I look at it as a form of looting. What do you think?
Oh, I think it's graft. I think it's, you know, I think that they've set up a situation where it absolutely is.
But isn't looting, I mean, isn't it kind of like during a blackout seeing some guy throw a brick through a window and run off with a TV set?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I see this as looting the American economy. And roughly half of all money that flows from the first world to the third world comes directly out of the U.S. economy.
Well, and so let's go back to those who this idea that's been implemented and been functioning, you know, as a practical matter in reality in real time for years. So what's the end game, do you think? I mean, with these plans that have been sort of taken place and, like I said, implemented within the banking system and within American territory and...
I don't necessarily see a coordinated effort. I mean, I know there are a lot of conspiracy theorists out there about everything.
Oh, and when I say in game, like, you know, when I go to trial, I mean, I have like a goal. I say, okay, I want to get, you know, these five things for my client. And if I can get three of them, I'll be happy.
Is that your phone? Your phone sounds like it's got a problem.
Sorry. Is it okay now?
No, it's echoing. Are you there? Hi, Lauren. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Ah, there you are.
I'm back. What
I'm
I was going to tell you is when
I can hear you fine now.
Oh, good. When I go to court and I have a client, they usually give me, you know, what they want to have happen, and so we say, well, we've got these five goals that we want to accomplish, and you go in, and if you get three out of five, you're happy, and
right.
It's a good day. So I think most people in jobs that they have, you know, a goal. It's not necessarily an in-game thing or whatever, but. The goal is to make
money.
Life
in this
better.
In this case, it's money, but for the politicians, it's the promise of votes, it's the promise of campaign contributions for the people who are making out literally and figuratively like bandits.
Right.
But, you know, it's just astonishing to me, because this undermines the average American worker, the average American family. Wages are continuing to decline in America, no shocker. Corporations
yeah.
that are focused on maximizing profits are ecstatic. There is a tactic that is used by corporations within their engineering departments, and it's called cost out. Are you familiar with the term cost out?
No, actually I'm not.
Okay, it's a new term. Cost out, or new for you, I guess, and it was new to me until I found out about it. What they will do is they have engineers working full-time at various companies, and their job is to find cheaper ways of making the same product. So if let's
that
say,
sounds good. I mean, that sounds like free market stuff, though. I mean, don't you always want to try to find cheaper ways to make a good product and,
well,
you
right.
know,
and,
in the free market?
I'm not arguing
system?
With you, but what happens with
yeah.
cost out, you reach a point of diminishing returns. If we shave a little bit of plastic off of here, or we use plastic instead of metal over there,
mm-hmm.
we can make it a little bit cheaper. So
they
okay, save
so you're
two
saying,
pennies
so you're
on an item, and then eventually
product.
It fails.
Yeah.
So now they got to go back and figure out, well, what do we have to put back that we took out so now it's going to kind of work okay? Rather
mm-hmm.
than saying we've got a winner here, let's just keep producing it because it works fine, there's the constant struggle to you know, wow, we're selling a piece of electrical equipment. If we could save 3 cents on that and we produce 10 million units, how much money are we going to save? I remember many years ago, Popular Mechanics used to run a monthly column. The other guy's job. I haven't seen that in years in the Popular Mechanics, but I do read it every month. And I remember one guy's job is, I believe he worked for the Ford Motor Car Company, and his job was to eliminate unnecessary screws in the dashboard. I'm serious.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
where they might have needed five screws in the original design, he found a way of making do with four screws. So the car is a little bit lighter. They save a screw per car. Of course, the motorists were getting screwed, I guess, by this process. But, you know, that's what they do. What's the least we need to hold the car together? It reminds me almost of Al Shepard's line when he was sitting on top of one of the early rockets in the space program and said, you know, I think it was Shepard who said it, how does it make you feel knowing that you're sitting on top of hundreds of thousands of gallons of volatile fuel on a rocket that was built by the lowest bidder? I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, you know, here's the thing is, and I remember reading that in the first class airlines, you know, when they used to do like super wonderful, you know, chef salads and they put
yep.
a lot of olives on there or whatever. And they decided that they just, you know, only put like, instead of 10 olives, they put like three. And they literally saved thousands of dollars. And
yep.
in a way, the customer's not too affected by, you know, a few less olives. But when you're starting to manufacture, and this is where it deviates from the free markets, because in the free markets, that kind of substandard work would never last for very long, because customer satisfaction becomes a huge factor when
you're
allowing...
Okay, but here's the problem. I'm gonna tie it together for you. Here's something for you to think about. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I want to make sure I don't lose this thought.
Okay.
Because I'm slowly losing my mind.
I know. Mine's going to be. You've been talking all day.
Lauren, you don't know it. I'm doing another show at 10 o'clock tonight.
I love you.
Huh?
I said, I love you. You are a true, it's lead, follow, or get out of the way. And you are a beacon of inspiration and light for people who, you know, if we could do just one fraction of what you do, you know, then America would be a better place.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much,
so,
Lauren.
Don't lose that thought while I'm, you know.
No. I've got it firmly. I'm hanging on to it with both hands, and I'm hanging on to dear life.
Okay.
I really have a problem with a lot of the stuff that's written in the New York Times these days, the New York Times. But it was interesting. 20 years ago, almost exactly 20 years ago, in 1993, they wrote an article about Roosevelt Avenue, and they depicted it accurately, the nexus between illegal immigration, the flow of money out of our country, and narcotics and houses of prostitution. Same situation exists today, but they would never write that article today. It's gotten so bad over there that I think they need to change their motto from all the news that's fit to print to one that's a little bit more appropriate. I would recommend they call it all, you'll get a fit from what we print. But about 20 years ago, they wrote another article, and it was very, very interesting. And it was about the advent of the professional manager. And they predicted the unraveling of America over this. It was a very sentient article. Because they said that in the old days, people like Henry Ford, he didn't have blood in his veins, he had motor oil. Howard Hughes didn't have skin, he had bird feathers, he was all about aviation. And you could go down the list of all these inventors and all these captains of industry who were passionate about what they did. So because of that, they were really involved with their product. But they said, now, not so much. The guy that's the senior vice president at Mobil Oil might be coveting a job at IBM and says, well, if over the next 3 years I don't show that I'm losing money, that I'm running solidly in the black, I have a shot at a different job at IBM that pays twice what my job is paying at Mobil. I'm using that as an example. God knows it might be the other way around. But the idea was you have these professional managers who don't care about the product. They're button pushers, and they are like widgets. They're interchangeable. You could take the guy from IBM, and you can move him to Hewlett-Packard. Then you could move him to General Motors. Then you could move him over to Seagram's and Verizon. Didn't matter. He is a manager. Well, if your goal is to stay on a job for 3 or 4 years and make certain that you don't run red ink, so that you look good on paper for your next prospective employer, then your goal is short term. You're not worried about the viability of your company or the survival of your company or the expansion. No, you're worrying about your career at the expense of all else. So you see companies that refuse to modernize their assembly lines. Why? Because if you spend $1 billion or whatever to modernize that assembly line, when you go to that other company that you want to go work for, they're going to say, well, you just spent $1 billion modernizing that assembly line. And you say to the guy, well, don't worry about it. In 3 years, they'll be doing better. They'll be in the black. They'll be making more. They won't look at that. They're going to look at the fact that you ran red ink and you're gone. So they don't want to modernize the plant. They don't want to do what they need to do, and they're looking to cut corners. If that means putting plants overseas, they'll do that. If it means hiring illegal aliens, they'll do that. If it means going to a lawyer and making sure to bring in foreign computer programmers who will charge less and demand less in the way of fringe benefits, then they will do that. And the immigration lawyers are thrilled to do that, because if they do that, they get their fees. So everybody makes out like a bandit, except for the poor schnook who goes to work one day and the boss calls him in and says, Charlie, you've been doing a great job for this company for the last 18 years, but you know what, Charlie? You're going to have to train your replacement. We've seen movies about the topic. And what people never drew the connection with is that kind of a movie is really a story about immigration and its failure. We keep hearing from Bill Gates and corporate heads, America can't stay competitive unless we import engineers, because Americans are too damn stupid. Then when you see who we keep on re-electing, maybe they got something there. But the point is that nobody connected the guy that had to train his replacement with being a component of the immigration story. Would you agree or disagree?
Yeah, I agree. And you know what? I'll tell you, this is the weird thing, though. When do you think incentives changed? I mean, how did – do you think that money is really always the bottom line for everything then? I mean, if the incentive is money, I mean, is there ever anything that people would want to do to make something grow or create a product that would be for anything – in addition to money? I mean,
well,
what it sounds
like, you would like to believe it, and
change.
I'm sure there are people that do that. I know there was, you know, some people will talk about how they've moved their companies back because they feel bad for Americans who are out of work, and they feel that Americans are harder working, and we are harder working than any other group. But, you know, it's case by case. But the climate of America has become so greedy. You know, I really think the beginning of the slide into oblivion that we seem to be going headlong into happened when the Supreme Court declared that corporations were constituents. I think that was around 1968 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got Citizens United that say that people can give unlimited amounts of money to campaigns. You know, I wasn't allowed to accept a cup of coffee when I was a federal agent. If I came to your house, Lauren, because your next-door neighbor was somebody I had an interest in because I thought he was a crook or a spy or a terrorist, or I might come to you, knock on the door, and you say, can I help you? Yes, my name is Mike Cutler. I'm a senior special agent with INS. I'm interested in the guy that lives two doors down from you. Do you know that guy? Well, come on in, Mr. Cutler. We're just having coffee now. Why don't you join us? What I was supposed to say to you, and what I always said to people, was thank you for the hospitality, but a glass of ice water would be perfect. Now think about that.
Yeah.
The idea was to hold the public at arm's length so people wouldn't say, oh, I've got this personal relationship with an immigration agent.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But now when you have politicians taking money with both hands and bragging about it, and their backers stand behind them clapping like a bunch of trained seals at the zoo.
Right. So, how do you think that you got to have such integrity in your job? I mean, what would make a person want to have integrity in the job? I mean, what made you choose to do the right thing?
You're hiring certain people to do a job. You know, one of the things that upsets me is I see where one of the punching bags today, especially on the conservative side, you know, I'm a Democrat, are civil servants. Oh, those darn civil servants! Government is the problem. It's the problem until you need a cop and you don't have enough cops in your town or enough federal agents. So we really need to be reasoned. I was listening to Stuart Varney over at Fox, and I like Stuart Varney. I think he does a good job. I like his style of reporting. But he was jumping up and down just 2 days ago. Union officials don't do any government work, but they're getting paid. The only union official who does 100% work for the union is the president of the local chapter. The union delegates and all those other people are given a certain percentage of their day that they can devote to union work, and the rest has to be devoted to the agency work. And the reason I'm mentioning it is because it's in fashion to vilify civil servants. Those lazy bums. You know, Ronald Reagan did that at a time when I was working sometimes 38, 39 straight hours. No sleep, no nothing, falling over. And we didn't get paid for it. Once
right.
You work 10 hours, salary.
I don't condone vilifying any general group or making any generalization.
But you see, what's happening here is this is the problem that we face in America. And yesterday when I was on a program in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and as soon as a link becomes available, I'm going to put it up on my website, and I'm quite sure they're going to put it up on the CAPS Web website also.
Very cool. And I was watching the Hazleton, Pennsylvania congressman speak in the clip that you sent me, too, and I loved what he had to say. That was an amazing clip.
Was
that
cool?
He did.
This is what we've been talking about for how long now?
So awesome.
I work with Lou Barlett. In fact, I called him right after he was on Fox and Friends yesterday. It was god-awful. He was up at 6:15, so I had to get up at about 5:45, so I had both eyes open by the time he was on. And then I called him after, drew on the phone for about a half hour. Imagine a member of Congress who's accessible. What a novel thought that is.
Amazing. It's wonderful.
But the point that I'm making, though, when I was on this program, they started out making immigration into this conservative issue. And I said, wait a minute. I'm an American. Yes, I'm a Democrat. And I think immigration's got to be controlled. Barbara Jordan, who was a black congresswoman who passed away a number of years ago, she had something called the Jordan Commission. And they looked into the issue of illegal immigration. And guess what Barbara Jordan's position, liberal Democrat, guess where she stood on immigration? She was opposed to illegal immigration, was completely in favor of effective immigration law enforcement.
Hmm.
You see?
Yeah.
So there's this mythology. And what I think has really happened is that Americans have been pitted against Americans. We are so busy duking it out between ourselves that crooked politicians and corporations and everybody else who's gaming the system for their own benefit are waltzing all over America and Americans while we're fighting with each other. We're ignoring what they're really doing.
It sounds like you're starting to get the aerial view. You really do. Because once you can step back out of it and not be chaotic and not be in a fight or flight mode all the time, which I think a lot of Americans are feeling just because they've been affected
personally. They're overwhelmed and bewildered.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And with that, you're right, creates chaos, and that allows predatory
dissension in the ranks. No, we're going
to
have dissension in the ranks, and then the army loses the fight because there's no discipline. Folks, keep your eye on the prize. Your neighbor who disagrees with you is not your enemy. He's an American or she's an American. That's their right. I don't always agree with you, Lauren. There are issues where we have our disagreements, but we're still good friends, and we still are both Americans. The founding fathers and their brilliance made the First Amendment the First Amendment. And, first things first. And what was the First Amendment? And everyone rattles off freedom of press, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. What are the other two, Lauren?
Well, the ability to gather and protest and rally.
It was about the right to seek redress for grievances.
Mm-hmm.
And as my favorite talk show host who passed away not that long ago, a couple years ago, used to say, if you ain't mad, you ain't paying attention. So certainly we have grievances. But the other one was the right for peaceable assemblage.
That's right.
Now, the reason that they talked about peaceable assemblage, they said, look, have at it, but leave your clubs, your guns, your knives at home. But to assemble for what purpose? Because back then there was no internet, there was no social media, there was no talk radio, there was no telephone. So the only way you could have a discussion, discourse, debate, argument, was to stand nose to nose and toe to toe with somebody and have it out. And the founding fathers knew the importance of that discourse, of the debate, of the argument. That is part of the democratic process.
Yes,
you know,
it is. Can you imagine our founding fathers saying, okay, now we're going to debate this particular issue, and let's just say it's the constitutionality of some particular law or something.
Right.
And can you imagine if they said, okay, we're going to put this before the floor, but we're only going to give it 1 hour to discuss.
Right.
Can you imagine if our founding father said that about what all the discussions that they had that took days and months and letter writing and
thinking? But isn't that what
a hearing is?
When you watch a congressional hearing, and I've done a bunch of them, all too often it's like being in a kangaroo court. You have 5 minutes, and that's it.
That's ridiculous.
It's like being on television, and they give you 3 minutes and 8 seconds. Tell us everything you know.
Yeah, so if you really want to get philosophical about it, time is actually not being leveraged for us anymore. Time is actually being used against us. When you give somebody,
understand that there's an agenda in play.
Mm-hmm.
And understand that when you have a position among your ranks in Congress called the whip,
Does that sound very Tory?
My mouth doesn't work too well. I think I've worn out the muscles today. Does it not sound like Tony Soprano and his enforcers, the whip, we're going to keep you in line or else?
Yeah, and it also sounds very parliamentarian, and certainly not, just servant leaders that are supposed to go up for a brief period of time and you know, serve constituents and then come back home. And you know,
who are your constituents today? It's the people with the deep pockets, isn't it?
It tends to be that, or, you know, lobbyist groups. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've seen even at the state level, you know, it's amazing how they go up into the state house, into the even our state capitol building, and the same is true in D.C. And, you know, they have numbers, they have checkbooks, they have lots of incentives that if people aren't really focused and grounded on what needs to be done. And it's we've deviated just so far from the Constitution. And you know that one of my biggest things is that I am a constitutional conservative. And I think that the Constitution is an amazing document that set up one of the greatest societies ever to have been envisioned at all. And we live in it. We are so blessed and honored to actually be living in this and to have this Constitution that allows so much freedom and really protects individual rights. But with the out-of-control government, it's very similar, and I love this analogy. 100 years ago, fire was an important element, and everybody used fire, and fire was so important that most people in their homes had a fireplace. And that was for the benefit of the family, and it worked really well. But when the fire had a few coals that would pop out onto the floor and hit the carpet, it became a serious threat to the family and to others, because eventually, if those coals weren't put back into the fireplace, the fire would become out of control and would extend into an out-of-control forest fire and go into the neighboring villages, and it could cause plenty of damage. I submit to you that our government is out of the fireplace. When the Constitution is the foundation that keeps the government in place, it gives it certain enumerated powers, of which Homeland Security and military is one, but it gives it certain enumerated powers, and if it expands past those powers, it becomes a serious threat to the way we live in our society. And our government is so far out of control, it's almost like those California wildfires, you know, right now. It is on a rampage of spending, corruption, ignoring the Constitution, favoring other laws, playing footsie with things like the Law of the Sea Treaty and other United Nations and World Bank issues. And these kind of things have allowed our government to come so far out of the fireplace that the only thing, and Thomas Jefferson said this very, very well, he said, the Constitution are the chains that hold the government and out-of-control government to get, you know, back in its place. And we have some interesting people running for Tim Scott's seat down here, and we've heard a lot of different things, and one of them has coined that Thomas Jefferson phrase, but he says that he needs to bring handcuffs up to Washington.
Well, you know, people have asked me from time to time why I don't run for Congress, and my answer is no, thank you. I don't run for Congress. I run from Congress. I can imagine where I'd wind up having fistfights with people in those hallowed halls.
Yeah. I mean,
what's so remarkable is that if you listen to the rhetoric, if you listen to the half-truths, if you listen to whether it's the administration or Chuck Schumer or Alan Greenspan going before Chuck Schumer April 30th, 2009, I keep coming back to it because I sat in my home stupefied, furious, angry, bewildered, because Greenspan actually talked about how we have created, in his judgment, a privileged elite. And he wasn't talking about some corporate executive making $100 million a year flying around the world in a 767 with the most opulent interior you could imagine. He said the privileged elite were Americans who had skills or education. I thought that was called the middle class. And he said the solution to the wage premium. I love that word, wage premium. You know what's remarkable about Alan Greenspan? We've all seen those pharmaceutical commercials where they tell you that if you have gastric distress or God knows what, take this pill, and then they rattle off all the negative side effects. You know, your eyes may pop out of your head, blood will pour from your ears. And the guy sounds like somebody on the Mecum Auto Auction. Lots of luck trying to understand exactly what he's saying. Well, Alan Greenspan's style is very different. It's in the exact opposite direction. rather than the guy coming at you at 150 miles an hour and it's this bombastic pounding of words on your eardrums and you don't even know what's going on. Mr. Greenspan talks in this very slow, syrupy kind of thing, and he talks about weight premium. Because we have to combat, what was the term that he used? Inequality of wages. And, you know, mm-hmm. that flat monotone voice. And you hear, you know, you want to go after inequality. Well, of course, we're all opposed to inequality. Not
right.
so much when you realize his inequality wasn't based on race or gender or ethnicity or religion, but skill level. Well, wait a moment, Alan Greenspan. Wasn't that the American dream, that the key to success in America very often was that education? And here's Mr. Greenspan saying, no, not so fast. An education should not entitle you to anything more. What he was really saying is that if you drop out of high school or you have a PhD within a slight margin of difference, you should be making the same money. I thought that was called communism. To each according to his need, and from each according to his ability. And there's Greenspan.
Oh, yeah. That's crazy.
And, you know,
I mean,
so
that
angry.
Really
I have to share this with you.
That makes me angry all over again for you, too, because it really is. And, you know, and that comes back to the heart of what, you know, I thought we were going to get to is it is education that we human beings, you know, actually have free conscious thinking and we're upright and we, you know, have civilized societies, right? The thing to that and the key to that is education and is expanding your mind. So how is it that... you know, and I feel like through my liberal arts education, that's how I learned virtues. And I learned, you know, that it's important to tell the truth and that honesty is good and that, you know, compassion is good.
Well, that's why
and that there's certain
humanities.
Absolutes.
It was called
exactly.
the humanities.
And that's why, you know, you most likely chose to be a man of integrity when you were working and still continue to work. And in your business, and you wouldn't take something that you really shouldn't take
but
under your job
you,
or in your profession.
The great majority of my colleagues, the great majority, 90-odd percent, were just as decent and honest. I wasn't the exception. I was the rule because we all were the same way. And we
right.
all looked with bewilderment and anger at the politicians that did what they did.
So, but don't you think that comes from education? I mean, don't you think that also comes? I mean, I know we're born with a sense of goodness.
You don't think Madoff
went
to college?
But
you don't think Madoff went to college?
Oh yeah, but when I talk about education, I'm talking about, you know, somebody teaching you the right way to live.
No,
I mean,
I don't agree with that. I had wonderful parents, and certainly being a parent seems to be a lost art these days. How many people, by
yeah,
the way,
that's
I know
what
we're really
you.
Digressing, and I want to get back to track, but how many people
yeah.
have you heard over the years say to you, oh, I want to be my 12-year-old's best friend? Every time I hear it, I cringe. You know, I
yeah.
have four of my own kids. My oldest son is going to be 29, which blows my mind because in my mind's eye, I'm still changing his diapers.
Mm-hmm.
Remarkable. He's taller than I am, and he's an engineer, and I'm very proud of him. I'm proud of all my kids. I'm very blessed. But, you know, you look at the way that we raise kids today. He can be my best friend now. He's going to be 29. He's married. He has a house. He has a career, a profession. But does a 12-year-old need a best friend, or does a 12-year-old need a parent?
Well, yeah, a 12-year-old needs a parent.
That's right.
And you're right. And so what you're saying, and all I'm saying is it doesn't. Bernie Madoff went to college, sure, smart. I'm saying where does, because this is what we're seeing in the graft in D.C., is there are so many people that find it so easy to do the wrong thing instead of the right thing.
Well, but this is going to go on forever. Mark Twain had a wonderful expression. He said, we no sooner send people to Washington than they forget who sent them and with what purpose.
Yeah, well, because power corrupts and absolute power
absolutely.
Corrupts absolutely.
Yes, and they see opportunities. Duke Cunningham, great American hero, he was the guy responsible for Navy's Top Gun flight school to teach dogfights to Navy aviators,
mm-hmm.
suddenly decided he could take some money, and he's in jail now because he wanted a Rolls Royce, and he wanted this, and he wanted that, you know. I look at the demands that certain people have for wealth, and it's scary. I compare unbridled greed with cancer, and I'll tell you why. Think about this. the people that really and truly have this overwhelming need to always get more and more and more. I'm not talking about the guy that's got a few thousand dollars and wants a secure future. That makes sense. I'm talking about the billionaire who still needs more. That billionaire who still needs more, the guy with six mansions who needs a seventh mansion, is really like a malignant tumor. Because, you see, malignant tumors have an insatiable appetite for nutrients. They even secrete chemicals that enable more blood vessels to form, so they get even more and more and more in the way of nutrients, and they strangle the healthy tissue around it. And cancer is a very successful organism right up until the day that it kills its host. Today, mm-hmm. we have corporations and corporate leaders who have insatiable appetites for wealth. And I'm not saying all of them do. It's a small group, but it's enough that it does a lot of damage. And
yeah,
my
the host
fear
is
just like a
anemic.
Cancer, they're going to kill this country. They are killing this country.
Mm.
Is that a reasonable analogy?
Yeah, it's an incredible analogy that hits home, and I think a lot of people can understand it. And so we've identified a lot of the problems. What do you think, as we're kind of wrapping up this hour, what do you think the solutions are? What can one person like me do?
Okay, number one, you have to educate yourself on the issues, because the politicians have become very adept at telling you what they think you want to hear. They come up with these wonderful field operations, Operation Return to Sender, Operation Safe Neighborhood, great. It sounds like they dug up General George S. Patton and breathed life into his corpse, stuffed him into his uniform.
I love him. I quoted him the other day. He said, I hope God has mercy on my enemies, because I'm not going to.
I love that. And the hero doesn't die for his country. He gets the other poor bastard to die for his country. But
that's right.
Yeah, boy, that was a great film too. But
I wish we could bring him back on the radio show.
I tell you, and Norm Schwarzkopf, for whom they just had a memorial service at West Point. But these were real leaders. But the point about where we are now is they do these great field operations, and they arrest a handful of people, and they say, "Aren't we great?" And people say, "See, they're doing the job." Wait a moment. How did those aliens come to be out on the street in the first place? And then you read the press release, because I love to go to the ICE website. You folks should do it, by the way. ICE website, ICE news releases. And it's amazing, because they'll talk about some guy, oh, this guy was in custody. This guy had been ordered deported. This guy was a fugitive. Well, wait a minute. You had them. You ordered them deported. You released them so you can catch them again. What are you, stocking the pond?
Right.
Stop and think about the lunacy of catch and release. So now they're saying, wow, we just grabbed 17 bad guys. They've been in custody before, but we turned them loose, just like we're doing now. So what's happening is we are endangering public safety.
Yeah.
We're playing games. I've gotten to the point that I believe that all those fancy field operation names should be changed by one name. Just call it what it is, Operation Backrub. We're going to go out there, folks. We're going to get in front of the microphones. We're going to do our best to convince you that the world is a great place and we're leading the charge just for you, so we can see you smile, because we're just wonderful. I get ill. I get physically ill when I could read the accounts of criminal aliens being turned loose. The Boston Globe article that was out recently, a couple months ago, talked about how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of criminal aliens are at large, because ICE turned them loose, just like they're doing now. See, I don't think that this is all that unique. I think they've been at it for quite some time. You have a president who thinks that our borders aren't much. And I'll be honest with you, Mitt Romney wasn't that much better. And I'll be honest with you, George W. Bush wasn't that much better. And I'll tell you what, neither was Ronald Reagan. It was Reagan who gave us the amnesty.
Yeah.
It was Ronald Reagan who said, we don't need any regulations. Regulations, we don't need any. Well, wait a moment. There's a lot of dumb regulations that are not doing anybody any good. They impede the growth of America and the success of our country. But certain regulations you need. You can't get on a highway without speed limits, because you're going to have a pretty good body count before too very long.
Exactly.
So we need sensible regulation, but in order to learn what's sensible, folks, you got to do your homework. You have to search out sources of information that you trust, but never trust any one source. You think I'm a good source of information? I'm flattered, and I hope you're listening every Friday night. That's why I sit down. I don't make money doing this. This is something that I do because I want to try to wake my fellow Americans up. But don't just take my word. Look for alternate sources. Look for the people who oppose me. See what they say. See, I'm not worried about discourse or debate. I welcome it because I know in my heart of hearts that what I'm doing is right, and I can substantiate it with facts, with statistics, with common sense, with knowledge, with law, and so forth. The other side, all they can do is make accusations and make deceptive use or use of deceptive language. So Understand the issues, learn as much as you can from as many diverse sources as you can, and then make your voice heard. Could you imagine if instead of 60% of the American voters turning out, if there was 90%, we would relegate those fringe voters to where they belong, the junkie.
Yes.
It would no longer matter. They would be irrelevant. But when you're running close to, you know, a 60% or a 55% voting level, every vote becomes that much more important, and the outcome can be swayed that much more easily because so many of us are not involved. Imagine if Americans were as emotional and as involved in their politics as they are with football games. Think of those guys who are tailgating, wearing no shirts, and they've got body paint on, supporting their team, and it's 3 degrees outside, and these bare-chested guys are running around screaming like wounded mooses. Moose?
Right.
I don't know. What's the plural?
Yeah.
But you know
I'm
going
to defer to you on that. Yeah.
But could you imagine if Americans had that level of enthusiasm like they do for Dancing with the Stars or Survivor or The Apprentice?
American Idol. I know. If we had half of the audiences, the millions of people, it would be an amazing, wonderful thing. And actually, I think that that can happen in America. I think that there can be a shift to people wanting to become, aware of, situationally aware of what's going on around them. I think a great source to look to is really to read the Constitution. I even went to law school, and even throughout law school, I hadn't ever read the Constitution all the way through until maybe a few years ago, when I started really taking constitutional research into account and making it an important part of my life, so that I was aware of what my rights were. And that's an original source. It is so important to go to original sources, like you said. And it is also important to engage in the debates with people that don't always agree with you, because iron often strengthens iron. And that's what we are as Americans. And we should be strong and come from a place that we come of a great land of abundance. We should try to edify each other, and we don't have to be like crabs in a bucket. We did not grow up. That's sort of like people who think from there's a scarcity thing and the sky's going to fall in and everything's going to
I just had this image of crabs in a bucket. I'm sorry.
Well, it is. A crab in a bucket can't ever get out because the other little crabs are always pulling him down, you know? And we don't live in that kind of a society. We live in
a wonderful society.
Oh,
my gosh. So. That's unbelievable.
I know. I knew I did something right tonight. The analogy of crabs in a bucket.
There's something else I want people to read. And let me tell you, I think that we should make certain to get our politicians to read it in Washington. And that's the 9/11 Commission report. Because one of the issues that they kept on hammering is that we were overly concerned, apparently, with the southwest border and ignoring the other components to what should be a coherent immigration system. Very important. Because, you see, if you look at what we're doing, we're allowing aliens to get official identity documents so we can't prove who they are. We're not enforcing immigration laws for people that violate the immigration laws. We are repeating the mistakes that allowed 9/11 to happen. And you know, we hear all this business about the border. I have to tell you, by the way, there is an amazing film. I want everybody to go online and look up this film that just came out, and it's called Freedom Under Fire Part 2. And you can go to my website, michaelcutler.net. I think Caps Web has a link up. If not, I'm going to see to it that they do. But Freedom Under Fire Part 2 was filmed by my friends Renee Griffith and Mark Hager and some other folks from North Carolina. They filmed along the Mexican border. They came to New York. We chatted in my own dining room here in New York, my own kitchen, And then we went out to Roosevelt Avenue, which we talked about earlier, to look at how the drug trade operates, to see those 24/7 money remitters that are open in the dead of night. It looks like daytime, other than the fact that it's dark outside.
Wow.
Folks, this is so critically important. Please check out that film. It's called Freedom Under Fire, Part 2. Super important. Mark Hager, in fact, is a history professor. I stayed at his house a couple of times. I considered him a friend. We've kind of all adopted each other. And this is the point. You're from South Carolina. He's from North Carolina. You guys are Christian. I'm a Jew. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. We couldn't be more different in many ways, but in the most important way that matters, we are the same.
That's true.
Conservative. You're a conservative. I'm not. We're Americans. We need to respect each other. We need to accept the fact that as Americans, we have that right to disagree. We just need to do so respectfully. The folks who would bring us down don't like the idea that Lauren and I are friends. They would rather that we looked across a DMZ at each other the way North and South Korea look at each other. And that's
not gonna
where
happen.
We lose. Am I not right about this, Lauren?
You're absolutely right, but that would never happen because, you know, on a very same level, you know, we are united. And and I value our friendship very much. And you're a great inspiration, like I said. And so you're absolutely right. And we're really looking into, it's 8 o'clock, so I'm going to have to run to take care of some things. But, you know, one of these next conversations, and I'm going to be sure to go to your website and look up that movie. I'm going to look forward to watching it and also to rereading the 9/11.
It's going to blow you away. You have to see this film. It's well made. I'm proud to be a part of it.
And then one of these days I'd like to talk to you about human trafficking because I was talking to our local solicitor here and finding out some unbelievable things about there's a whole, you know, subculture within our culture, and I'll look forward to, you know, talking to you about that another time.
But I want to make this point, and I'm going to let you run, and then I'll wrap up. But here's the thing that I want everyone out there to understand. It is not anti-immigrant to want immigration laws enforced. This is as absurd as saying that if you didn't want to own a slave during that dark era of American history, that it meant you didn't like black people. I don't want to see people exploited. I don't want to see the crime that begets other crime, whether it's identity theft committed by illegal aliens, whether it's houses of prostitution that open up to cater to the illegals who come here without their girlfriends and wives.
Right.
Understand that this is a bunch of cascading dominoes. It's destroying our society. It's destroying the lives of vulnerable, desperate people. It's destroying the American dream for Americans. This is not in anyone's best interest. We as a country need to go back and understand the unusual nature of our country, the fact that America is the seat of exceptionalism. That's been lost in this whole business. The discussions by the politicians that if we don't bring in foreign workers, we're either too lazy to do the tough jobs or too stupid to do the high-tech jobs. That's insulting. And we need to prove to those politicians we're not as dumb as they were hoping we were when we make sure that they find themselves looking for a job the next time there's an election.
That's the spirit of America, and you've really said it very well. And as always, it is such an honor to be on your radio program. Thank you so much for all the work that you do, and I'm going to say God bless you and God bless America, and I will catch up with you later.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You, Lauren. I'm going to stay on for a little bit, folks. You can stay with me just for a couple of minutes before I bail out. But absolutely, and I thank you for joining me, Lauren. Folks, really and truly, I want you to look at what the Obama administration is now doing, continuing this insane process of releasing criminal aliens into communities across America. It's dangerous for our country. It's dangerous for Americans. This is not representative of our government's best intent. We've got a problem. And the solution is to make certain that the politicians hear from us. This is supposed to be representative democracy. We're not getting that with these actions taken by our government. We have that responsibility. That's why I always like to talk about the fact that democracy is not a spectator sport. When we go to restaurants, we're very specific about the food that we want to eat, the way that we want it prepared. If we don't like the meal, we send it back to the kitchen. And if that doesn't work, we leave. I don't like this meal, folks. It's giving me heartburn. I'm sure you don't feel much better about it. It's time to speak up. Speaking up is our obligation. Having discussions with our neighbors is as American as apple pie. And don't approach your neighbor with animosity. Approach them with the understanding that I'm sure that they're probably looking for what's best for everyone also, but they might be misguided. I was part of a panel discussion, the debate, if you will, last night. And the gentleman who was seated next to me, who initially disagreed with me, by the end of the evening told me that I had raised a lot of issues that he'd never thought of. That's the reason for the First Amendment. Discourse, debate, discussion, if necessary, argument. We need to honor and respect those who disagree with us and try to see them as the allies that we've yet to win over, because we can win them over, and we can win them over with the facts. We can win them over with the truth. It's an important job. Have at it. I thank all of you for joining me this Friday. Look forward to speaking with all of you again next Friday, right here on the Michael Cutler Hour. And again, I remind you, democracy is not a spectator sport, folks. Get involved. Our country depends on it. Good night, everybody. Have a great weekend.